it tears you apart, leaves an empty feeling deep inside your heart. The good is love when it tortures your mind, brings disappointments, oh, the hurting kind. I love you, girl, more than I can really bear. When I need you, you're
Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Joey Strobel from Joey Strobel and the Runaways. Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is April 29, 2018, and I'm talking today with Joey Strobel. Joey, what is your date of birth in your hometown, please?
Oh, I was born June 24th, 1939, in the city of Brooklyn, New York.
What is your first recollection about becoming involved with music?
Well, the doo-wops became very popular, and I listened to the radio a lot. In fact, I used to walk around the neighborhood with a little portable radio, or very large batteries at that time, holding it up to my ear and singing as loud as I could on the street corners. In fact, even sometimes at night, we'd be all singing, and people would be throwing shoes out the window at us. And just in the hallways of, like, the drugstore, I always had a good echo system, so we'd go in there and all sing. And okay, we sang in the entryways. We started with about 10 guys wanting to sing, and I was always kind of the leader, and I guess I had a pretty good ear, so I'd give parts out, and some of the parts we doubled, but some of the guys couldn't really sing, and we never had the heart to tell them anything, that they couldn't sing, especially the bigger ones, you know. So we used to try to meet sometimes without them. And I remember my friend Nunzio had got really upset with us one time because he found out that we were rehearsing without him. But he was one of the guys that was a little tone deaf, and we just didn't have the heart to say anything.
So, what kind of songs did you sing?
We sang a lot of doo-wops, like Over the Mountain, and I don't know, anything that was popular in the early 50s.
Like Earth Angel?
Earth Angel, sure, we did Earth Angel. And You're a Thousand Miles Away, and yeah, OG, and we did Stay, and Crazy Love, where we sing really high.
How about Al Jolson?
Okay, before all this, when I was just probably about 11 years old, I used to sing in my living room when there was nobody around in the day after school. And my dad was a big fan of Al Jolson. So he had, that's what he had, all Al Jolson records. And I liked Al Jolson. I saw him on TV. So, but I was afraid to, I found out that I didn't sing out enough, you know. So I used to hold my ears, and I didn't hear myself as loud, but I was projecting. I think that's where I gained some strength in my voice, by holding my ears. I didn't want to do it in front of anybody, but that's what I sang a lot. Nobody ever complained, so I kept doing it for years.
Did you eventually join a group?
Yes, I did. I got to be friends with my girlfriend moved out of the neighborhood we lived in, and she moved out to Bensonhurst around on 58th Street in the Utrecht Avenue. And I got to be friends with a guy by the name of Carmine Amuso. He knew a group called the Overons that had a lead singer that just got drafted in the Army. And he said, "Why don't I?" He heard me sing, goes, we used to fool around in the corner with Carmine. We went to a concert at the Paramount Theater, had Alan Freed there, a rock concert. And we went down in the men's room down there because they were down there singing. I could hear them even when we were going downstairs. And Carmine introduced me to these guys, and I sang Crazy Love, which was just, I wanted to show my voice in a high tone. So I pretty much got the job right there, you know, as far as, it wasn't a job really. It's just the privilege of singing with these guys. And they were nice, all Italian guys.
Where did they play?
Well, they didn't really play anywhere. They used to rehearse in a church and sing maybe at a sorority. You know, there were lots of girls that had these sororities around for school. And every now and then they would have, there was a movie theater up on 80th Street. Every now and then they'd have live music. You know, you could go in there and sing. Any amateurs could do that, and we did that. And we craved an audience. So, and it was they all sang good harmony, and we had fun. We even went to a couple contests where the best singers, you know, we were down to two groups once. I don't remember the name of the club, but it was a tie every week for 3 weeks, which we started getting, well, how come it's a tie all the time? So we'd have to go back to the next week and pack the place with family and friends, and finally we just didn't go anymore. I guess we never had a winner.
So these would be lounges in Brooklyn?
Yes, lounges and places big enough to have live music and stuff.
Now I understand you picked up a guitar at some point.
Well, yeah, when we had the Overons, I met a guy who played guitar. Tommy Crescenti was his name, and he had a Gibson, and I loved this guitar. And after a while, I started talking to him about, geez, I'd love to play this. He says, well, I can teach you some chords. He called them bar chords and little chords. And I went out and bought myself just a little cheap guitar. He started giving me lessons, you know. But I didn't want to play guitar when he played guitar because the other guys in the band weren't playing any instruments and didn't want to be too pushy. Well, anyway, after a while, I started getting more involved with the guitar, and didn't seem like the group was really going anywhere. We were doing all this free stuff, just singing for fun. It was very enjoyable because they were good. But Tommy Crescenti knew some musicians. Before you know it, I had a little group. That's when I met some guys that we called, what was the name of it?
The Crystals?
The Crystals, yeah. And that's when we met Jimmy Nebb and Art Crafer, who had a hit song out, and they had some money they wanted to invest in a group, and they did that.
What happened to the Mystics?
Well, the Overons got a different lead singer, and they stayed with it for several months, and they got lucky and came out with Hushabye. And people started teasing me. Geez, Joe, you should have stayed with that group. You would have had a hit record. But they...
So the Overons turned into the Mystics.
They changed their name after I left. Okay. They weren't doing anything for a while. So in time, I'm not quite sure how long it took them, between the time I left and the time that record came out. 6 months, maybe a year, maybe a little longer. But
about Hushabye?
Hushabye, yeah.
Hushabye came out in the spring of 1959.
Mm-hmm. So I probably left right about a year before that.
Okay.
So it turned out to be a good omen for them, you know, but... Anyway, it was nice to know that I was with the Graham and, you know, the group and knew everybody, but mm-hmm. I was very happy for him too. But I was playing, I was doing what I wanted to do. I was playing with the little band, the Crystals at that time.
And they had a 45 out, right?
First 45 that was played was a rock version of the old standard Malaguena. And then I think later on it was Twisting and Dixie. And they were played, but they didn't make the charts, you know. Just there were a lot of people putting out records then.
And what happens next?
The same two guys that helped, that I met, Art Crafer and Jimmy Nebb, got a hold of Joe Villa, and he had a record out by the Three Friends called Blanche. Actually, when I was down in the basement of the Paramount Theater auditioning for the Overons then, who became the Mystics, they were playing upstairs. The Three Friends. But after that record, Blanche, they didn't go anywhere, so we started a new group called Joey and the Twisters. They had a different guitar player at first, but this guy left, and then I took over, and that's when we went to Dick Clark's show a couple of times, and the Buddy Dean show on the East Coast. He used to have a lot of bands. Just was kind of like a Dick Clark show. And we did the Dave Garraway show, like I mentioned before, and just little things.
Now, at this point in time, had The Twist come out by Chubby Checker?
Yeah, but I think The Twist was already out. I remember him being... When we did the Dick Clark show, I think he was there. It's hard to remember.
And The Twist by Chubby Checker in 1960, I mean, it triggered a national dance craze, correct?
That's true. Oh, yeah, we remember. He was everywhere, you know, and it was good. And he was a good dancer.
Did Joey and the Twisters play at the Peppermint Lounge?
Yes, they did. We were there for a couple of years, actually. Saw a lot of people there. We also played in, they had a Peppermint Lounge in Miami, and we played down there for a while.
So Joey D and the Starlighters had a hit with the Peppermint Twist. That was early 62. Are you there before that?
No, we were there after them.
After that?
After them.
After he had the hit song, mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, he made the place popular. That's why we wanted to get in there, because we figured we'd do well in there. We had a pretty good band, you know.
Okay, now I understand Joey and the Twisters came to Minneapolis in the late part of 62, correct?
Yes. We played at a place called the Jockey Club.
Where was that located?
Downtown Minneapolis. And I'm not sure exactly where it was. It was on Hennepin Avenue. I'm pretty sure of that.
Joey, I understand that your first night in town, there was a little activity on the TV with the President John F. Kennedy, right?
Yes, it was kind of a bad time to start a new gig. But we got there, and the club was empty because we were all watching John F. K. talk about the possible war. And pictures of Khrushchev and the ships coming here and ships coming there. We were all a little nervous. Maybe this is going to be the big one. Fortunately, we didn't have hardly anybody in the club, so we didn't do much. The next day, we found out that in the papers and stuff that the ships had started turning around. So we all kind of breathed a sigh of relief that maybe we're still going to be here in a couple of days.
So, according to my records, that speech by JFK occurred on October 22nd, 1962. And, of course, this is the era of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Do you recall the owner of the Jockey Club?
Well, his name is Dave. That I remember very distinctly, but I don't remember his last name.
Okay. And at some point, you make a trip to New Orleans, right?
Yes, we did. We played at a place called the Dream Room, and we were there actually for a couple of years. And it was a wild place. There were other bands there. They had three bands, actually. And on Saturdays, we used to play till 4 o'clock in the morning. And another band would come in, about a seven-piece band. I don't remember the name of them, but they would play till 8 o'clock in the morning. They were kind of like a Dixie band. So it was a wild club, very big place, and was right in the French Quarter.
And I understand you met Johnny Rivers there.
Yes, I did. Johnny Rivers played. And I used to request songs. He used to do a song called Jailer Bring Me Water, which I thought was a great song. And I used to request that. And I got to know the guitar player in his band, too. And I would request that all the time. And sometimes we'd sit together when the third band was playing, because, like I said, there'd be three bands sometimes. And I got to know him a little bit. And we talked about, he told me he lived in Shreveport and how they used to go on these little wooden canoes on the bayou and go fishing and stuff. And I said, oh, New York. We didn't do stuff like that in Brooklyn. I mean, he used to, so he got to like the fact that I was from a whole different world, and we got to be friends. And when that gig was over and I was back to New York, I got a call from him. It surprised me that he asked me if I'd be interested in being in his band and fronting his group, because things were going good for him. And I thought about it, but I had to turn it down because I was gone for quite some time and I had a wife and family already.
But fronting this group, you mean replacing Johnny Rivers?
No. Fronting the band, like as far as the music. I think he was going to put his guitar down and just sing. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It was just a conversation on the phone.
And I understand that Joey and the Twisters put out a 45 too.
Yes, they did. They had a thing called Boney Maroney, which we did on the Dick Clark show. And I remember Dick Clark showing he really liked the version. He's a very nice man, Dick Clark, probably one of the most warm-hearted guys I've ever met in the music business.
What was the B-side?
Mumbling. You know, I don't remember much of Mumbling. I really don't.
How long did Joey and the Twisters last?
Oh, just a couple of years, 2.5 years, maybe 3 years, between the Peppermint Lounge. 3 years, I'd have to say, at least. And going to Miami and New Orleans, at least 3 years, maybe not more.
What brought the band to an end?
Well, we weren't making enough money. We were traveling around paying expenses, and when you have a manager and an agent and dues to pay, things got a little tight financially. So I just kind of shied away from that.
So you decided to return to Minnesota, correct?
Yes, I liked it. Minneapolis. I had some good friends, even though New York is full of really excellent, talented musicians. It is kind of a bit of a rat race as far as, you know, trying to get a gig and make a living. And I noticed we went over really well. I've been in Minneapolis, so I went back to Minneapolis, and actually we ended up in Loveland, Colorado. We played at a place, I can't even remember the name of this place, between Loveland and Fort Collins. And we were there, and that's pretty much when I put the group together with some horns. And then we played. I went to Denver after that and played at a place called the La Pache, which is French for the pitcher, because you could get big pitchers of 3-2 beer. And the manager really liked the horns. He said, "That's different. We have three tenor saxophones."